am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 66, in which we get around to chapters 12 and 13 of When the World Shook by H. Rider Haggard. I'm afraid that, as sometimes happens, these chapters have a bit more breathing noise than I'm really happy with. It's all a matter of how loud I'm speaking versus how noisy my breathing is, which tends to deteriorate over the course of a long session of reading. Now, I'm thinking I may have made an error in not giving Oro a slightly gravelier sort of old man voice. "They were wicked and disobeyed me, and they must be destroyed," sort of thing. As it is, the voice I've given him is a little too close to that of Baston, and I find Baston's voice drifting slightly in the sort of Oli and Lena direction, which is perhaps not desirable. Now, Baston talks a bit about the Bible and what's in it in these chapters, and to be perfectly honest, I don't think the views expressed are quite those of an Orthodox Anglican clergyman. I detect a certain influence, in fact, of the Ethiopian Book of Enoch, which, considering the spiritualistic elements in the rest of the book, probably comes from Helena Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society, who in turn obtained it from the Swedenborgians of the late 18th century. You know, aside from a couple of mentions in the Gospels, the Bible doesn't say a great deal about hell, and the idea that Noah caused the flood rather than simply being warned in advance of it is another curious point. I dare say that as we go on, there will be more examples of this influence of the Book of Enoch, which also had a great influence on the work of the poet William Blake, although much of the work he produced under that influence was considered obscene in his day and suppressed. Well, anyway, I have to go winterize my lava lamps. Chapter 12. 250,000 years.
"You seem to have made the best of your time, old fellow," said Bickley, in a rather a sour voice.
"I never knew people begin to call each other by their Christian names so soon," added Baston, looking at me with a suspicious eye.
"I know no other," I said.
"Perhaps not, but at any rate you have another, though you don't seem to have told it to her. Anyway, I am glad they are gone, for I was getting tired of being ordered by everybody to carry about wood and water for them. Also, I am terribly hungry, as I can't eat before it is light. They have taken most of the best fruit to which I was looking forward, but thank goodness they do not seem to care for pork."
"So am I," said Bickley, who really looked exhausted. "Get the food, there's a good fellow. We'll talk afterwards." When we had eaten, somewhat silently, I asked Bickley what he made of the business, also whither he thought the sleepers had gone.
"I think I can answer the last question," interrupted Baston. "I expect it is a place well known to students of the Bible, which even Bickley mentions sometimes when he is angry. At any rate, they seem to be very fond of heat, for they wouldn't part from it even in their coffins, and you will admit that they are not quite natural, although that glittering lady is so attractive as regards her exterior."
Bickley waved these remarks aside and addressed himself to me. "I don't know what to think of it," he said, "but as the experience is not natural, and everything in the universe, so far as we know it, has a natural explanation, I am inclined to the belief that we are suffering from hallucinations, which in their own way are also quite natural. It does not seem possible that two people can really have been asleep for an unknown length of time, enclosed in vessels of glass or crystal kept warm by radium or some such substance, and then emerge from them comparatively strong and well. It is contrary to natural law." "How about microbes?" I asked. "They are said to last practically forever, and they are living beings. So, in their case, our natural law breaks down." "That is true," he answered. "Some microbes in a sealed tube and under certain conditions do appear to possess indefinite powers of life. Also, radium has an indefinite life, but that is a mineral. Only, these people are not microbes, nor are they minerals. Also, experience tells us that they could not have lived for more than a few months at the outside in such circumstances as we seem to find them."
"Then, what do you suggest?"
I suggest that we did not really find them at all, that we have all been dreaming. You know that there are certain gases which produce illusions, laughing gas is one of them, and that these gases are sometimes met with in caves. Now, there were a pair of very peculiar odors in that place under the statue, which may have worked upon our imaginations in some such way. Otherwise, we are up against a miracle, and as you know, I do not believe in miracles.
I do, said Bastion calmly. You'll find all about it in the Bible, if you will only take the trouble to read. Why do you talk such rubbish about gases?
Because only gas or something of the sort could have made us imagine them.
Nonsense, Bickley. Those people were here right enough. Didn't they eat our fruit and drink the water I brought them without ever saying thank you? Only they are not human. They are evil spirits, and for my part I don't want to see any more of them, though I have no doubt Arbuthnot does, as that glittering lady threw her arms round his neck when she woke up, and already he is calling her by her Christian name, if the word Christian can be used in connection with her. The old fellow had the impudence to tell us that he was a god, and it is remarkable that he should have called himself Oro, seeing that the devil they worship on the island is also called Oro, and the place itself is named Orofena.
As to where they have gone, continued Bickley, taking no notice of Bastin, I really don't know. My expectation, however, is that when we go to look tomorrow morning, and I suggest that we should not do so before then in order that we may give our minds time to clear, we shall find that sepulchre place quite empty, even perhaps without the crystal coffins we have imagined to stand there.
Perhaps we shall find that there isn't a cave at all, and that we are not sitting on a flat rock outside of it, suggested Bastin, with heavy sarcasm. You are clever in your way, Bickley, but you can talk more rubbish than any man I ever knew.
They told us they would come back tonight or tomorrow, I said. If they do, what will you say then, Bickley? I will wait till they come to answer that question. Now, let us go for a walk and try to change our thoughts. We are all overstrained and scarcely know what we are saying. One more question, I said, as we rose to start. Did Tommy suffer from hallucinations as well as ourselves? Why not? Answered Bickley. He is an animal just as we are, or perhaps we thought we saw Tommy do the things he did. When you brought that basket of fruit, Bastin, which the natives brought over in the canoe, was there a bough covered with red flowers lying on top of it?
Yes, Arbuthnot, one bough only. I threw it down on the rock as it got in the way when I was carrying the basket.
Which flowering bough we all thought we saw the sleeper Oro carry away after Tommy had brought it to him.
Yes, he made me pick it up and give it to him, said Bastin.
Well, if we did not see this, it should still be lying on the rock, as there has been no wind and there are no animals here to carry it away. You will admit that, Bickley.
He nodded.
Then, if it has gone, you will admit also that the presumption is that we saw what we thought we did see. I do not know how that conclusion can be avoided, at any rate so far as the incident of the bough is concerned, replied Bickley with caution. Then, without more words, we started to look. At the spot where the bough should have been, there was no bough, but on the rock lay several of the red flowers, bitten off, I suppose, by Tommy while he was carrying it. Nor was this all. I think I have mentioned that the glittering lady wore sandals which were fastened with red studs that looked like rubies or carbuncles. On the rock lay one of these studs. I picked it up, and we examined it. It had been sewn to the sandal strap with golden thread or silk. Some of this substance hung from the hole drilled in the stone which served for an eye. It was as rotten as tinder, apparently, with extreme age. Moreover, the hard gem itself was pitted, as though the passage of time had taken effect upon it, though this may have been caused by other agencies, such as the action of the radium rays. I smiled at Bickley, who looked disconcerted and even sad. In a way, it is painful to see the effect upon an able and earnest man of the upsetting of his lifelong theories. We went for our walk, keeping to the flat lands at the foot of the volcano cone, for we seemed to have had enough of wonders, and to desire to reassure ourselves, as it were, by the study of natural and familiar things. As it chanced, too, we were rewarded by sundry useful discoveries. Thus we found a place where the bread tree and other fruits, most of them now ripe, grew in abundance, as did the yam. Also we came to an inlet that we noticed was crowded with large and beautiful fish from the lake, which seemed to find it a favorite spot. Perhaps this was because a little stream of excellent water ran in here, overflowing from the great pool or mere which filled the crater above. At these finds we rejoiced greatly, for now we knew that we need not fear starvation, even should our supply of food from the main island be cut off. Indeed, by help of some palm leaf stalks which we wove together roughly, Bastin, who was rather clever at this kind of thing, managed to trap four fish weighing 2 or 3 pounds apiece, wading into the water to do so. It was curious to observe with what ease he adapted himself to the manners and customs of primeval man, so much so, indeed, that Bickley remarked that if he could believe in reincarnation, he would be absolutely certain that Bastin was a troglodyte in his last sojourn upon the earth. However this might be, Bastin's primeval instincts and abilities were of the utmost service to us. Before we had been many days on that island, he had built us a kind of native hut or house, roofed with palm leaves, in which, until provided with a better, as happened afterwards, we ate, and he and Bickley slept, leaving the tent to me. Moreover, he wove a net of palm fiber, with which he caught abundance of fish, and made fishing lines of the same material. Fortunately, we had some hooks, which he baited with freshwater mussels and the insides of fish. By means of these, he secured some veritable monsters of the carp species that proved most excellent eating. His greatest triumph, however, was a decoy, which he constructed of boughs, wherein he trapped a number of waterfowl. So that soon we kept a very good table of a sort, especially after he had learned how to cook our food upon the native plan, by means of hot stones. This suited us admirably, as it enabled Bickley and myself to devote all our time to archaeological and other studies, which did not greatly interest Baston. By the time that we got back to camp, it was drawing towards evening, so we cooked our food and ate, and then, thoroughly exhausted, made ourselves as comfortable as we could, and went to sleep. Even our marvelous experiences could not keep Bickley and myself from sleeping, and on Baston such things had no effect. He accepted them, and that was all, much more readily than we did indeed. Triple-armed as he was, in the mail of a childlike faith, he snapped his fingers at evil spirits which he supposed the sleepers to be, and at everything that other men might dread. Now, as I have mentioned, after our talk with Marama, although we did not think it wise to adventure ourselves among them again at present, we had lost all fear of the Orofenans. In this attitude, so far as Marama himself and the majority of his people were concerned, we were quite justified, for they were our warm friends. But in the case of sorcerers, the priests and all their rascally and superstitious brotherhood, we were by no means justified. They had not forgiven Baston his sacrilege, or for his undermining of their authority by the preaching of new doctrines, which, if adopted, would destroy them as a hierarchy. Nor had they forgiven Bickley for shooting one of their number, or any of us for our escape from the vengeance of their god. So it came about that they made a plot to seize us all and hale us off to be sacrificed to a substituted image of Oro, which by now they had set up. They knew exactly where we slept upon the rock, indeed our fire showed it to them, and so far they were not afraid to venture, since here they had been accustomed for generations to lay their offerings to the god of the mountain. Secretly, on the previous night, without the knowledge of Marama, they had carried two more canoes to the borders of the lake. Now, on this night, just as the moon was setting, about 3 a.m, they made their attack, 21 men in all, for the 3 canoes were large, relying on the following darkness to get us away and convey us to the place of sacrifice to be offered up at dawn and before Marama could interfere. The first we knew of the matter, for most foolishly we had neglected to keep a watch, was the unpleasant sensation of brawny savages kneeling on us and trussing us up with palm fiber ropes. Also, they thrust handfuls of dry grass into our mouths to prevent us from calling out, although as air came through the interstices of the grass we did not suffocate. The thing was so well done that we never struck a blow in self-defense, and although we had our pistols at hand, much less could we fire a shot. Of course, we struggled as well as we were able, but it was quite useless. In 3 minutes we were as helpless as calves in a net, and like calves were being conveyed to the butcher. Baston managed to get the gag out of his mouth for a few seconds, and I heard him say in his slow, heavy voice, "This, Bickley, is what comes of trafficking with evil spirits in museum cases." There his speech stopped, for the grass wad was jammed down his throat again, but distinctly I heard the inarticulate Bickley snort as he conceived the repartee he was unable to utter. As for myself, I reflected that the business served us right for not keeping a watch and abandoned the issue to fate. Still, to confess the truth, I was infinitely more sorry to die than I should have been 48 hours earlier. This is a dull and in most ways a dreadful world, one if we could only summon the courage that some of us would be glad to leave in search of new adventures. But here a great and unprecedented adventure had begun to befall me, and before its mystery was solved, before even I could formulate a theory concerning it, my body must be destroyed and my intelligence that was caged therein sent far afield. Or, if Bickley were right, eclipsed. It seemed so sad, just when the impossible, like an unguessed wandering moon, had risen over the gray flats of the ascertained and made them shine with hope and wonder. They carried us off to the canoes, not too gently. Indeed, I heard the bony frame of Baston bump into the bottom of one of them and reflected, not without venom, that it served him right as he was the fount and origin of our woes. Two stinking magicians, wearing on their heads undress editions of their court cages, since these were too cumbersome for active work of the sort, and painted all over with various pigments, were just about to swing me after him into the same, or another, canoe, when something happened. I did not know what it was, but as a result my captors left hold of me, so that I fell to the rock, lying upon my back. Then, within my line of vision, which, it must be remembered, was limited because I could not lift my head, appeared the upper part of the tall person of the ancient who said that he was named Oro. I could only see him down to his middle, but I noted vaguely that he seemed to be much changed. For instance, he wore a different colored dress, or rather robe. This time it was dark blue, which caused me to wonder where on earth it came from. Also, his tremendous beard had been trimmed and dressed, and on his head there was a simple black cap, strangely quilted, which looked as though it were made of velvet. Moreover, his face had plumped out. He still looked ancient, it is true, and unutterably wise, but now he resembled an antique youth, so great were his energy and vigor. Also, his dark and glowing eyes shone with a fearful intensity. In short, he seemed impressive and terrible almost beyond imagining. He looked about him slowly, then asked in a deep, cold voice, speaking in the Orofenan tongue,
"What do you do, slaves?"
No one seemed able to answer. They were too horror-stricken at this sudden vision of their fabled god, whose fierce features of wood had become flesh. They only turned to fly. He waved his thin hand and they came to a standstill, like animals which have reached the end of their tether and are checked by the chains that bind them. There they stood in all sorts of postures, immovable, and looking extremely ridiculous in their paint and feathers, with dread unutterable stamped upon their evil faces. The sleeper spoke again.
"You would murder, as did your forefathers, O children of snakes and hogs, fashioned in the shape of men. You would sacrifice those who dwell in my shadow to satisfy your hate because they are wiser than you. Come hither, thou."
And he beckoned with a bony finger to the chief magician. The man advanced toward him in short jumps, as a mechanical toy might do, and stood before him, his miniature crate and feathers all awry, and the sweat of terror melting the paint in streaks upon his face.
"Look into the eyes of Oro, O worshipper of Oro," said the sleeper,
and he obeyed, his own eyes starting out of his head.
"Receive the curse of Oro," the ancient spoke again.
Then followed a terrible spectacle. The man went raving mad. He bounded into the air at a height unconceivable. He threw himself upon the ground and rolled upon the rock. He rose again and staggered round and round, tearing pieces out of his arms with his teeth. He yelled hideously like one possessed. He groveled, beating his forehead against the rock. Then he sat up, slowly choked, and died. His companions seemed to catch the infection of death, as terrified savages often do. They, too, performed dreadful antics, all except three of them who stood paralyzed. They rushed about, battering each other with their fists and wooden weapons, looking like devils from hell in their hideous painted attire. They grappled and fought furiously. They separated and plunged into the lake, where with a last grimace they sank like stones. It seemed to last a long while, but I think that as a matter of fact within 5 minutes it was over. They were all dead. Only the three paralyzed ones remained standing and rolling their eyes. The sleeper beckoned to them with his thin finger, and they walked forward in step-like soldiers.
"Lift that man from the boat," he said, pointing to Bastin. "Cut his bonds and those of the others."
They obeyed with a wonderful alacrity. In a minute we stood at liberty and were pulling the grass gags from our mouths. The ancient pointed to the head magician, who lay dead upon the rock, his hideous contorted countenance staring open-eyed at heaven.
"Take that sorcerer and show him to the other sorcerers yonder," he said, "and tell them where your fellows are, if they would find them. Know by these signs that the Oro, god of the mountain who has slept a while, is awake. And ill will it go with them who question his power, or dare to try to harm those who dwell in his house. Bring food day by day and await commands. Begone."
The dreadful-looking body was bundled into one of the canoes, that out of which Bastin had emerged. A rower sprang into each of them, and presently was paddling as he had never done before. As the setting moon vanished, they vanished with it, and once more there was a great silence.
"I am going to find my boots," said Bastin. "This rock is hard, and I hurt my feet kicking at those poor fellows who appear to have come to a bad end. How, I do not exactly understand. Personally, I think that more allowances should have been made for them, as I hope will be the case everywhere, since, after all, they only acted according to their lights."
"Curse their lights!" ejaculated Bickley, feeling his throat, which was bruised. "I'm glad they are out!" Bastin limped away in search of his boots, but Bickley and I stood where we were, contemplating the awakened sleeper. All recollection of the recent tumultuous scene seemed to have passed from his mind, for he was engaged in a study of the heavens. They were wonderfully brilliant now that the moon was down, brilliant as they can only be in the tropics, where the sky is clear. Something caused me to look round, and there, coming towards us, was she who said her name was Eva. Evidently all her weakness had departed also, for now she needed no support, but walked with a peculiar gliding motion that reminded me of a swan floating forward on the water. Well had we named her the Glittering Lady, for in the starlight literally she seemed to glitter. I suppose the effect came from her golden raiment, which, however, I noted, as in her father's case, was not the same that she had worn in the coffin. Also from her hair, that seemed to give out a light of its own. At least, she shimmered as she came, her tall shape swaying at every step like a willow in the wind. She drew near, and I saw that her face, too, had filled out, and now was that of one in perfect health and vigor, while her eyes shone softly and seemed wondrous large. In her hands she carried those two plates of metal which I had seen lying in the coffin of the sleeper Oro. These she gave to him, then fell back out of his hearing, if it were ever possible to do this, a point on which I am not sure, and began to talk to me. I noticed at once that in the few hours during which she was absent, her knowledge of the Orofenin tongue seemed to have improved greatly, as though she had drunk deeply from some hidden font of memory. Now she spoke it with readiness, as Oro had done when he addressed the sorcerers, although many of the words she used were not known to me, and the general form of her language appeared archaic, as for instance that of Spencer is, compared with modern English. When she saw I did not comprehend her, however, she would stop and cast her sentences in a different shape till at length I caught her meaning. Now I give the substance of what she said. "You are safe," she began, glancing first at the palm ropes that lay upon the rock and then at my wrists, one of which was cut. "Yes, Lady Eva, thanks to your father." "You should say thanks to me. My father was thinking of other things, but I was thinking of you strangers, and from where I was, I saw those wicked men coming to kill you." "Oh, from the top of the mountain, I suppose." She shook her head and smiled, but vouchsafed no further explanation, unless her following words can be so called. These were, "I can see otherwise than with my eyes, if I choose." A statement that caused Bickley, who was listening, to mutter, "Impossible! What the deuce can she mean? Telepathy, perhaps?" "I saw," she continued, "and told the Lord my father. He came forth. Did he kill them? I did not look to learn." "Yes, they lie in the lake, all except three whom he sent away as messengers." "I thought so. Death is terrible, O Humphrey, but it is a sword which those who rule must use to smite the wicked and the savage." Not wishing to pursue this subject, I asked her what her father was doing with the metal plates. "He reads the stars," she answered, "to learn how long we've been asleep. Before we went to sleep, he made two pictures of them, as they were then, and as they should be at the time he had set for our awakening."
"We set that time," interrupted Bickley.
"Not so, Bickley," she answered, smiling again. "In the divine Oro's head was the time set. You were the hand that executed his decree." When Bickley heard this, I really thought he would have burst. However, he controlled himself nobly, being anxious to hear the end of this mysterious fib. "How long was the time that the Lord Oro set apart for sleep?" I asked. She paused, as though puzzled to find words to express her meaning, then held up her hands and said, 10, nodding at her fingers. By second thoughts, she took Bickley's hands, not mine, and counted his 10 fingers.
10 years, said Bickley. "Well, of course it is impossible, but perhaps—"
And he paused.
10 tens, she went on with a deepening smile. 100.
"Oh," said Bickley.
10 hundreds, 1,000.
"I say," said Bickley.
10 times 10,000, 100,000.
Bickley became silent.
"Twice 100,000 and half 100,000, 250,000 years. That was the space of time which the Lord Oro, my father, set up for our sleep. Whether it has been fulfilled, he will know presently, when he has read the Book of the Stars, and made comparison of it with what he wrote before he laid us down to rest."
And she pointed to the metal plates which the ancient was studying. Bickley walked away, making sounds as though he were going to be ill, and looking so absurd in his indignation that I nearly laughed. The Lady Eva actually did laugh, and very musical was that laugh.
"He does not believe," she said. "He is so clever, he knows everything. But 250,000 years ago, we should have thought him quite stupid. Then we could read the stars and calculate their movements forever."
"So can we," I answered, rather nettled.
"I am glad, O Humphrey, since you will be able to show my father, if in one of them he is wrong."
Secretly, I hoped that this task would not be laid on me. Indeed, I thought it well to change the subject for the edification of Bickley, who had recovered and was drawn back by his eager curiosity. Just then, too, Baston joined us, happy in his regained boots. "You tell us, Lady Eva," I said, "that you slept, or should have slept, for 250,000 years. Here Baston opened his eyes. "If that was so, where was your mind all this time?"
"If by my mind you mean spirit, O Humphrey, I have to answer that at present I do not know for certain. I think, however, that it dwelt elsewhere, perhaps in other bodies on the earth, or some different earth. At least, I know that my heart is very full of memories which as yet I cannot unroll and read."
"Great heavens, this is madness," said Bickley.
"In the great heavens," she answered slowly, "there are many things which you, poor man, would think to be madness, but yet are truth and perfect wisdom. These things, or some of them, soon I shall hope to show you."
"Do if you can," said Bickley.
"Why not?" interrupted Baston. "I think the lady's remark's quite reasonable. It seems to me highly improbable, if really she has slept for 250,000 years, which, of course, I can't decide, that an immortal spirit would be allowed to remain idle for so long. That would be wallowing in a bed of idleness and shirking its duty, which is to do its work. Also, as she tells you, Bickley, you are not half so clever as you think you are in your silly skepticism, and I have no doubt that there are many things in other worlds which would expose your ignorance if only you could see them."
At this moment, Oro turned and called his daughter. She went at once, saying, "Come, strangers, and you shall learn." So we followed her.
"Daughter,"
he said, "speaking in Orofenan, I think that we might understand.
Ask these strangers to bring one of those lamps of theirs, that by the light of it I may study these writings."
"Perhaps this may serve," said Bickley, suddenly producing an electric torch from his pocket and flashing it into his face. It was his form of repartee for all he had suffered at the hands of this incomprehensible pair. Let me say at once that it was singularly successful. Perhaps the wisdom of the ages in which Oro flourished had overlooked so small a matter as electric torches, or perhaps he did not expect to meet with them in these degenerate days. At any rate, for the first and last time in my intercourse with him, I saw the god or lord, the native word bears either meaning, Oro, genuinely astonished. He started and stepped back, and for a moment or two seemed a little frightened. Then, muttering something as to the cleverness of this light-producing instrument, he motioned to his daughter to take it from Bickley and hold it in a certain position. She obeyed, and in its illumination he began to study the engraved plates, holding one of them in either hand. After a while he gave me one of the plates to hold, and with his disengaged hand pointed successively to the constellation of Orion, to the stars Castor, Pollux, Aldebaran, Rigel, the Pleiades, Sirius, and others which, with my very limited knowledge, I could not recognize offhand. Then, on the plate which I held, he showed us those same stars and constellations, checking them one by one. Then he remarked very quietly that all was in order, and handing the plate he held to Eva, he said,
"The calculations made so long ago are correct, nor have the stars varied in their proper motions during what is, after all, but an hour of time. If you, stranger, who I understand are named Humphrey, should be, as I gather, a heaven master, naturally you will ask me how I could fix an exact date by the stars without an error of, let us say, from 5 to 10,000 years. I answer you that by the proper motion of the stars alone, it would have been difficult. Therefore, I remember that in order to be exact, I calculated the future conjunctions of these two planets," and he pointed to Saturn and Jupiter. "Finding that one of these occurred near yonder star," and he indicated the bright orb Spica, "at a certain time I determined that then I would awake. Behold, there are the stars as I engraved them from my foreknowledge upon this chart, and there these two great planets hang in conjunction. Daughter Eva, my wisdom has not failed me. This world of ours has traveled round the sun neither less nor more than 250,000 times since we laid ourselves down to sleep. It is written here and yonder." And he pointed, first to the engraved plates, and then to the vast expanse of the starlit heavens. Awe fell on me. I think that even Bickley and Baston were awed, at any rate for the moment. It was a terrible thing to look on a being, to all appearance more or less human, who alleged that he had been asleep for 250,000 years, and proceeded to prove it by certain ancient star charts. Of course, at the time I could not check those charts, lacking the necessary knowledge, but I have done so since and found that they are quite accurate. However, this made no difference, since the circumstances and something in his manner convinced me that he spoke the absolute truth. He and his daughter had been asleep for 250,000 years. Oh, heavens! For 250,000 years! Chapter 13. Oro Speaks and Baston Argues.
The reader of what I have written, should there ever be such a person, may find the record marvelous, and therefore rashly conclude that, because it is beyond experience, it could not be. It is not a wise deduction, as I think Bickley would admit today, because, without doubt, many things are which surpass our extremely limited experience. However, those who draw the veil from the unknown and reveal the new must expect incredulity and accept it without grumbling. Was that not the fate, for instance, of those who, in the Middle Ages, a few hundred years ago, discovered, or rather rediscovered, the mighty movements of those constellations which served Oro for an almanac? But the point I want to make is that, if the skeptic plays a Bickleian part as regards what has been written, it seems probable that his attitude will be accentuated as regards that which it still remains for me to write. If so, I cannot help it, and must decline entirely to water down or doctor facts and thus pander to his prejudices and ignorance. For my part, I cannot attempt to explain these occurrences. I only know that they happened, and that I set down what I saw, heard, and felt, neither more nor less. Immediately after Oro had triumphantly vindicated his stellar calculations, he turned and departed into the cave, followed by his daughter, waving to us to remain where we were. As she passed us, however, the glittering lady whispered, this time to Baston, that he would see them again in a few hours, adding, "We have much to learn, and I hope that then you, who I understand are a priest, will begin to teach us of your religion and other matters." Baston was so astonished that he could make no reply, but when they had gone, he said,
"Which of you told her that I was a priest?"
We shook our heads, for neither of us could remember having done so.
"Well, I did not," continued Baston, "since at present I have found no opportunity of saying a word in season. So I suppose she must have gathered it from my attire, though as a matter of fact I haven't been wearing a collar, and those men who wanted to cook me pulled off my white tie, and I didn't think it worthwhile dirtying a clean one."
"If," said Bickley, "you imagine that you look like the minister of any religion, ancient or modern, in a grubby flannel shirt, a battered sun helmet, a torn green and white umbrella, and a pair of ragged duck trousers, you are mistaken, Baston, that is all."
"I admit that the costume is not appropriate, Bickley, but how otherwise could she have learned the truth?"
"These people seem to have ways of learning a good many things. But in your case, Baston, the cause is clear enough. You have been walking about with the head of that idol, and always keep it close to you. No doubt they believe you are a priest of the worship of the god of the grove, Baal, you know, or something of that sort." When he heard this, Baston's face became a perfect picture. Never before did I see it so full of horror, struggling with indignation.
"I must undeceive them without a moment's delay," he said,
and was starting for the cave when we caught his arms and held him.
"Better wait till they come back, old fellow," I said, laughing. "If you disobey that Lord Oro, you may meet with another experience in the sacrifice line."
"Perhaps you are right, Arbuthnot. I will occupy the interval in preparing a suitable address."
"Much better occupied in preparing breakfast," said Bickley. "I have always noticed that you are at your best extempore." In the end, he did prepare breakfast, though in a distrait fashion. Indeed, I found him beginning to make tea in the frying pan. Baston felt that his opportunity had arrived, and was making ready to rise to the occasion. Also we felt, all three of us, that we were extremely shabby-looking objects, and though none of us said so, each did his best to improve his personal appearance. First of all, Bickley cut Baston's and my hair, after which I did him the same service. Then Bickley, who was normally clean-shaven, set to work to remove a beard of about a week's growth, and I, who wore one of the pointed variety, trimmed up mine as best as I could, with the help of a hand-glass. Baston, too, performed on his, which was of the square and rather ragged type, wisely rejecting Bickley's advice to shave it off altogether, offered, I felt convinced, because he felt the result on Baston would be too hideous for words. After this, we cut our nails, cleaned our teeth, and bathed. I even caught Bickley applying hair tonic from his dressing case in secret, behind a projecting rock, and borrowed some myself. He gave it to me on condition that I did not mention its existence to Baston, who, he remarked, would certainly use the lot and make himself smell horrible. Next, we found clean ducks among our store of spare clothes, for the Orophanans had brought these with our other possessions, and put them on, even adding silk cummerbunds and neckties. My tie I fastened with a pin that I obtained in Egypt. It was a tiny gold statuette of very fine and early workmanship, of the god Osiris, wearing the crown of the upper land with the Uraeus crest, and holding in his hands, which projected from the mummy wrappings, the emblems of the crook, the scourge, and the crux-ansata, or sign of life. Baston, for his part, arrayed himself in full clerical costume, black coat and trousers, white tie and stick-up clergyman's collar, which, as he remarked, made him feel extremely hot in that climate, and were unsuitable to domestic duties, such as washing up. I offered to hold his coat while he did this office, and told him he looked very nice indeed. "Beautiful," remarked Bickley, "but why don't you put on your surplice and biretta?" Being very high church, Baston did wear a biretta on festival Sundays at home. "There would be no mistake about you, then."
"I do not think it would be suitable," replied Baston, whose sense of humor was undeveloped. "There is no service to be performed at present, and no church, though perhaps that cave—"
And he stopped. When we had finished these vain adornments, and Baston had put away the things and tidied up, we sat down rather at a loose end. We should have liked to walk, but refrained from doing so for fear lest we might dirty our clean clothes. So we just sat and thought. At least, Bickley thought, and so did I for a while, until I gave it up. What was the use of thinking, seeing that we were face to face with a circumstance which baffled reason and beggared all recorded human experience? What Baston did, I am sure I do not know, but I think, from the expression of his countenance, that he was engaged in composing sermons for the benefit of Oro and the Glittering Lady. One diversion we did have. At about 11 o'clock a canoe came from the main island, laden with provisions and paddled by Morama and two of his people. We seized our weapons, remembering our experiences of the night, but Morama waved a bow in token of peace. So, carrying our revolvers, we went to the rock edge to meet him. He crept ashore and, chief though he was, prostrated himself upon his face before us, which told me that he had heard of the fate of the sorcerers. His apologies were abject. He explained that he had no part in the outrage of the attack, and besought us to intercede on behalf of him and his people with the awakened god of the mountain, whom he looked for with a terrified air. We consoled him, as well as we could, and told him that he had best be gone before the god of the mountain appeared, and perhaps treated him as he had done the sorcerers. In his name, however, we commanded Morama to bring materials and build us a proper house upon the rock, Also, to be sure to keep up a regular and ample supply of provisions. If he did these things, and anything else we might from time to time command, we said that perhaps his life and those of his people would be spared. This, however, after the evil behavior of some of them, of course we could not guarantee. Morama departed so thoroughly frightened that he even forgot to make inquiries as to who this god of the mountain might be, or where he came from, or whither he was going. Of course, the place had been sacred among his people from the beginning, whenever that may have been, but that its sacredness should materialize into an active god who brought sorcerers of the highest reputation to a most unpleasant end just because they wished to translate their preaching into practice was another matter. It was not to be explained even by the fact of which he himself had informed me, that during the dreadful storm of some months before, the cave mouth, which previously was not visible on the volcano, had suddenly been lifted up above the level of the Rock of Offerings. Although, of course, all religious and instructed persons would have expected something peculiar to happen after this event. Such, I knew, were his thoughts, but, as I have said, he was too frightened and too hurried to express them in questions that I should have found it extremely difficult to answer. As it was, he departed quite uncertain as to whether one of us was not the real god of the mountain, who had power to bring hideous death upon his molesters. After all, what had he to go on to the contrary, except the word of three priests who were so terrified that they could give no coherent account of what had happened? Of these events, it was true, there was evidence in the twisted carcass of their lamented high sorcerer, and for the matter of that, of certain corpses which he had seen that lay in shallow water at the bottom of the lake. Beyond, all was vague, and in his heart I am sure that Morama believed that Bastin was the real god of the mountain. Naturally, he would desire to work vengeance on those who tried to sacrifice and eat him. Moreover, had he not destroyed the image of the god of the grove, and borne away its head whence he had sucked magic and power? Thus argued Morama, disbelieving the tale of the frightened sorcerers, for he admitted as much to me in after days. Morama departed in a great hurry, fearing lest the god of the mountain, or Bastin, whose new and splendid garb he regarded with much suspicion, might develop some evil energy against him. Then we went back to our camp, leaving the industrious Bastin, animated by a suggestion from Bickley that the fruit and food might spoil if left in the sun, to carry it into the shade of the cave. Owing to the terrors of the Orophanans, the supply was so large that to do this he must make no fewer than 7 journeys, which he did with great goodwill, since Bastin loved physical exercise. The result on his clerical garments, however, was disastrous. His white tie went awry, squashed fruit and roast pig gravy ran down his waistcoat and trousers, and his high collar melted into limp crinkles in the moisture engendered by the tropical heat. Only his long coat escaped, since that Bickley kindly carried for him. It was just as he arrived with the 7th load in this extremely disheveled condition that Oro and his daughter emerged from the cave. Indeed, Bastin, who being short-sighted always wore spectacles that, owing to his heated state, were covered with mist, not seeing that dignitary, dumped down the last basket onto his toes, exclaiming,
"There, you lazy beggar, I told you I would bring it all, and I have."
In fact, he thought he was addressing Bickley, and playing off on him a troglodytic practical joke. Oro, however, who at his age did not appreciate jokes, resented it and was about to do something unpleasant, when with extraordinary tact his daughter remarked,
"Bastin the priest makes you offerings. Thank him, O Lord my father."
So Oro thanked him, not too cordially, for evidently he still had feeling in his toes, and once more Bastin escaped. Becoming aware of his error, he began to apologize profusely in English, while the Lady Ava studied him carefully.
"Is that the costume of the priests of your religion, O Bastin?"
she asked, surveying his disheveled form.
"If so, you were better without it."
Then Bastin retired to straighten his tie, and grabbing his coat from Bickley, who handed it to him with a malicious smile, forced his perspiring arms into it in a peculiarly awkward and elephantine fashion. Meanwhile, Bickley and I produced 2 camp chairs which we had made ready, and on these the wondrous pair seated themselves side by side.
"We have come to learn," said Oro. "Teach!"
"Not so, father," interrupted Eva, who I noticed was clothed in yet a 3rd costume, though whence these came I could not imagine. "First I would ask a question. Whence are you, strangers, and how came you here?"
"We are from the country called England, and a great storm shipwrecked us here, that, I think, which raised the mouth of this cave above the level of this rock," I answered.
"The time appointed having come when it should be raised," said Oro, as though to himself.
"Where is England?" asked Eva.
Now, among the books we had with us was a pocket atlas, quite a good one of its sort. By way of answer, I opened it at the map of the world and showed her England. Also, I showed her, to within 1,000 miles or so, the spot on the Earth's surface where we spoke together. The sight of this atlas excited the pair greatly. They had not the slightest difficulty in understanding everything about it, and the shape of the world, with its division into hemispheres, seemed quite familiar to them. What appeared chiefly to interest them, and especially Oro, were the relative areas and positions of land and sea.
"Of this, strangers," he said, pointing to the map, "I shall have much to say to you when I have studied the pictures of your book, and compared them with others of my own."
"So he has got maps," said Bickley in English, "as well as star charts. I wonder where he keeps them."
"With his clothes, I suspect,"
suggested Baston.
Meanwhile, Oro had hidden the atlas in his ample robe and motioned to his daughter to proceed. "Why do you come here from England so far away?" the Lady Eva asked, a question to which each of us had a new answer.
"To see new countries," I said.
"Because the cyclone brought us," said Bickley.
"To convert the heathen to my own Christian religion," said Baston,
which was not strictly true. It was on this last reply that she fixed. "What does your religion teach?" she asked.
"It teaches that those who accept it and obey its commands will live again after death, forever in a better world where is neither sorrow nor sin," he answered.
When he heard this saying, I saw Oro start as though struck by a new thought and look at Baston with a curious intentness.
"Who are the heathen?" Eva asked again after a pause, for she also seemed to be impressed.
"All who do not agree with Baston's spiritual views," answered Bickley.
"Those who, whether from lack of instruction or from hardness of heart, do not follow the true faith. For instance, I suppose that your father and you are heathen,"
replied Baston stoutly. This seemed to astonish them, but presently Eva caught his meaning and smiled, while Oro said,
"Of this great matter of faith we will talk later. It is an old question in the world."
"Why," went on Eva, "if you wished to travel so far, did you come in a ship that so easily is wrecked? Why did you not journey through the air, or better still, pass through space, leaving your bodies asleep, as, being instructed, doubtless you can do?"
"As regards your first question," I answered, "there are no aircraft known that can make so long a journey."
"And as regards the second," broke in Bickley, "we did not do so because it is impossible for men to transfer themselves to other places through space, either with or without their bodies." At this information, the glittering lady lifted her arched eyebrows and smiled a little, while Oro said,
"I perceive that the new world has advanced but a little way on the road of knowledge."
Fearing that Baston was about to commence an argument, I began to ask questions in my turn. "Lord Oro and Lady Eva," I said, "we have told you something of ourselves, and will tell you more when you desire it, but pardon us if first we pray you to tell us what we burn to know. Who are you? Of what race and country, and how came it that we found you sleeping yonder?"
"If it be your pleasure, answer, my father," said Eva.
Oro thought a moment, then replied in a calm voice,
"I am a king who once ruled much of the world as it was in my day, though it is true that much of it rebelled against me, my counselors and servants. Therefore I destroyed the world as it was then, save only certain portions, whence life might spread to the new countries that I raised up. Having done this, I put myself and my daughter to sleep for a space of 250,000 years, that there might be time for fresh civilizations to arise. Now I begin to think that I did not allot a sufficiency of ages, since I perceive from what you tell me that the learning of the new races is yet but small."
Bickley and I looked at each other and were silent. Mentally, we had collapsed. Who could begin to discuss statements built upon such a foundation of gigantic and paralyzing falsehoods? Well, Baston could, for one. With no more surprise in his voice than if he were talking about last night's dinner, he said,
"There must be a mistake somewhere, or perhaps I misunderstand you. It is obvious that you, being a man, could not have destroyed the world. That could only be done by the power which made it and you."
I trembled for the result of Baston's methods of setting out the truth. To my astonishment, however, Oro replied,
"You speak wisely, priest, but the power you name may use instruments to accomplish its decrees. I am such an instrument."
"Quite so," said Baston, "just like anybody else. You have more knowledge of the truth than I thought, but pray, how did you destroy the world?"
"Using my wisdom to direct the forces that are at work in the heart of this great globe, I drowned it with a deluge, causing one part to sink and another to rise, also changes of climate, which completed the work."
"That's quite right," exclaimed Baston delightedly. "We know all about the deluge, only you are not mentioned in connection with the matter. A man, Noah, had to do with it when he was 600 years old.
600, said Oro. "That is not very old. I myself had seen more than 1,000 years when I lay down to sleep."
1,000, remarked Baston, mildly interested.
"That is unusual, though some of these mighty men of renown, we know, lived over 900.
Here Bickley snorted and exclaimed, 900 moons, he means.
"I did not know Noah," went on Oro. "Perhaps he lived after my time and caused some other local deluge. Is there anything else you wish to ask me before I leave you, that I may study this map writing?"
"Yes," said Baston. "Why were you allowed to drown your world?"
"Because it was evil, priest, and disobeyed me and the power I serve."
"Oh, thank you," said Baston. "That fits in exactly. It was just the same in Noah's time."
"I pray that it is not just the same now," said Oro, rising. "Tomorrow we will return. Or, if I do not, who have much that I must do, the lady my daughter will return, and speak with you further."
He departed into the cave, Eva following, at a little distance.
I accompanied her as far as the mouth of the cave, as did Tommy, who all this time had been sitting contentedly upon the hem of her gorgeous robe, quite careless of its immemorial age, if it was immemorial, and not woven yesterday, a point on which I had no information. "Lady Eva," I said, "did I rightly understand the Lord Oro to say that he was 1,000 years old? "Yes, O Humphrey, and really he is more, or so I think." "Then are you 1,000 years old also?" I asked, aghast. "No, no," she replied, shaking her head. "I am young, quite young, for I do not count my time of sleep." "Certainly you look it," I said. "But what, Lady Eva, do you mean by young?" She answered my question by another. "What age are your women, when they are as I am?" "None of our women were ever quite like you, Lady Eva. Yet, say, from 25 to 30 years of age. "Ah, I have been counting, and now I remember. When my father sent me to sleep, I was 27 years old. No, I will not deceive you. I was 27 years and 3 moons. Then, saying something to the effect that she would return, she departed, laughing a little in a mischievous way, and although I did not observe this till afterwards, Tommy departed with her. When I repeated what she had said to Basson and Bickley, who were standing at a distance, straining their ears and somewhat aggrieved, the former remarked,
"If she is 27, her father must have married late in life, though of course it may have been a long while before he had children."
Then Bickley, who had been suppressing himself all the while, went off like a bomb. "Do you tell us, Baston," he asked, "that you believe one word of all this ghastly rubbish? I mean as to that antique charlatan being 1,000 years old and having caused the flood and all the rest?"
"If you ask me, Bickley, I see no particular reason to doubt it at present. A person who can go to sleep in a glass coffin kept warm by a pocketful of radium, together with very accurate maps of the constellation of the time he wakes up, can, I imagine, do most things."
"Even cause the deluge," jeered Bickley.
"I don't know about the deluge, but perhaps he may have been permitted to cause a deluge. Why not? You can't look at things from far enough off, Bickley, and if something seems big to you, you conclude that therefore it is impossible. The same power which gives you skill to succeed in an operation, that hitherto is held impracticable, as I know you have done once or twice, may have given that old fellow power to cause a deluge. You should measure the universe and its possibilities by worlds and not by acres, Bickley."
"And believe, I suppose, that a man can live 1,000 years, whereas we know well that he cannot live more than about 100.
"You don't know anything of the sort, Bickley. All you know is that over the brief period of history with which we are acquainted, say 10,000 years at most, men have only lived to about 100. But the very rocks which you are so fond of talking about tell us that even this planet is millions upon millions of years of age. Who knows, then, but that at some time in its history men did not live for 1,000 years, and that lost civilizations did not exist of which this Oro and his daughter may be 2 survivors.
"There is no proof of anything of the sort," said Bickley.
"I don't know about proof, as you understand it, though I have read in Plato of a continent called Atlantis that was submerged, according to the story of old Egyptian priests. But personally I have every proof, for it is all written down in the Bible at which you turn up your nose, and I am very glad that I have been lucky enough to come across this unexpected confirmation of the story. Not that it matters much, since I should have learned all about it when it pleases Providence to remove me to a better world, which in our circumstances may happen any day. Now I must change my clothes before I see to the cooking and other things."
"I am bound to admit," said Bickley, looking after him, "that old Basson is not so stupid as he seems. From his point of view, the arguments he advances are quite logical. Moreover, I think he is right when he says that we look at things through the wrong end of the telescope. After all, the universe is very big, and who knows what may happen there? Who knows even what may have happened on this little Earth during the eons of its existence, whenever its balance chanced to shift, as the Ice Ages show has been done? Still, I believe that old Oro to be a prince of liars." "That remains to be proved," I answered cautiously. "All I know is that he is a wonderfully learned person of most remarkable appearance, and that his daughter is the loveliest creature I ever saw." "There, I agree," said Bickley decidedly. "And as brilliant as she is lovely, if she belongs to a past civilization, it is a pity that it ever became extinct. Now, let's go and have a nap. Baston will call us when supper is ready."
I hope you have enjoyed what you have heard, and I look forward to your comments. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. The Campaign for Real Mail thanks you. No promises, but there's a good chance I'll read out whatever you send me. If you like these shows enough to support them, and you're not comfortable mailing envelopes full of cash, you can set up a recurring monthly tip for the storyteller at patreon.com/ Publius_reads.